The Harpsichord Sonata by Scarlatti, catalogued by the Scarlatti expert Ralph Kirkpatrick as number 491. It was brilliantly played there by András Steyer, and that's just about it for this morning's programme. Next week, Tasman Little plays Howard Ferguson's second violin sonata, and from 10 till 11, I'm treating you to a musical taste of the Orient, with music by, among others, Rachmaninoff, Nielsen, Takamitsu and Mozart. As to my work, reflecting folk music, that's by the Romanian master George Enescu, his wonderful, sweet Impressions of Childhood, idiomatically played by Sherban Lupu. It's a real winner, and if you don't know it, please do try and tune in. So, I do hope you'll join me next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
And, of course, presented by Rob Cowan.
He's the English composer who never turned his back on writing good tunes. Continuing our celebration of British music on BBC Radio 3, and in this year, which marks George Lloyd's centenary, I'll be tracing his rise to fame as a young opera composer, his traumatic wartime experience in the Arctic convoys, and his time in the musical wilderness when he spent 20 years farming carnations and mushrooms. All this before an extraordinary Indian summer when the public lapped up his melodies once more. Our Radio 3 Composer of the Week is George Lloyd, weekday lunchtimes at 12 noon with an early evening repeat on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now, as part of our British music season here on BBC Radio 3, Michael Barclay's guests on Private Passions this month are leading poets from across the country. Today, the Northern Ireland-born poet Paul Muldoon.
One of the preeminent poets of his generation and a professor of creative writing, Paul Muldoon is increasingly drawn to music, writing both song lyrics and opera libretti. Paul's first collection of poetry was published when he was just 19 and soon caught the eye of Seamus Heaney. A dozen more volumes have followed. He's the winner of the Pulitzer, T.S. Eliot and Irish Times prizes for poetry, the poetry editor of The New Yorker, and for 5 years he was a professor of poetry at Oxford. But secretly, Paul Muldoon, would you not rather have been a rock star?
I do love rock and roll. I go to lots of rock concerts. I enjoy all that aspect of things. I even play one or two chords on a guitar and, in some sense, pretend to be in a rock band myself. But, you know, I don't know if I would. I mean, I've seen a few rock stars close up, and there are various problems about being a rock star. One of the main ones, actually, is that one can't walk down the street. I think that's a really serious problem, and I know a few people who can't be out and about. But I think that for many of us who are primarily interested in poetry, simply being brought up in that era, I was born in 1951, so my life has been coincidental, I suppose, with the rise of rock and roll.
You've lived largely in the United States since 1987, got wife and two children there, and you now teach at Princeton. In your recent poems, there is, though, a pull back, perhaps, towards Ireland?
You know, I think one's constantly, as a writer, or indeed any kind of artist with a small a, trying to make sense of one's life. And in my case, the first 35 years of my life were spent in Northern Ireland. I was brought up in County Armagh, then lived for a long time in Belfast. And I think one's constantly trying to make sense of that first part of one's life. I was raised as a Catholic, and one of my first influences, I suppose, was church music, the hymns from the Catholic tradition. Though in a strange way, more recently, I've become more and more interested in the hymns from the Church of Ireland tradition. And one of my great heroines, I suppose, is Mrs. Alexander, Cecil Frances Alexander, who wrote so many of the great hymns, All Things Bright and Beautiful, All Creatures Great and Small, and one for which I have a particular affection, which is There is a Green Hill Far Away.
There's a little twist in it, isn't there, where it suddenly goes down a semitone and it gives it a kind of lift. Writing something which is as simple as that is quite tricky to write something memorable.
Well, I think that simplicity is certainly the most difficult thing to achieve. But that pattern, that structure, and for many that stricture is extremely difficult. And if one is writing words for music, one more or less has to, having established a pattern in the first verse, say, one more or less has to stick with it. And that's difficult for many people, including myself.
Written, as you said, by Mrs. Alexander, and she was obsessed, wasn't she, with the city walls of Derry. In fact, I think they looked out on them, she and her husband.
That's right. She was born in Dublin, spent a great deal of her life in Derry, a very charged landscape then as now, but one which I think is maybe seen nowadays as inclusive as much as exclusive.
Well, we heard the choirs of Belfast Cathedral, directed by Philip Stopford, with the organist Ian Barber. There is a Green Hill Far Away by Mrs. Alexander. What about Irish music, folk music?
When I was a kid growing up in Northern Ireland in County Armagh, often one would be sitting at home at night and a knock would come to the door and a neighbour would come in for a little visit, or what we call over there a ceilidh. And more often than not, they would sit down and after a cup of tea or maybe something stronger, they would sing a song. And when I was a child, I studied the piano. Needless to say, my mother was very interested in improving me and my brother and my sister. She did her best. send us out to elocution and to piano lessons. The piano lessons didn't quite work out, so she sold the piano. She may well have had it in hire purchase. I can't never really quite figure that out. And she bought a tape recorder. So we had the neighbours coming round and we'd be recording their songs. We were part of the folklore gathering tradition as much as part of it. And the songs that were being sung came from a wide range of provenances, I suppose. There were certainly songs from the Irish, the native Irish tradition, ballads, versions translations of songs from Irish, some of them, of course, written by Thomas Moore. And then many music hall songs that had entered the popular imagination.
Do you still have those recordings, Paul?
You know, I believe I have them somewhere, but, you know, they were recorded in the 1960s on a reel-to-reel machine, an old Philips machine. Can't remember what speed they were at. They were, they weren't at 7.5, or they might have been at, what would that have been, 3.75?
Yes, or 15, if they were very professional.
And, of course, the tradition of the song in Ireland having, in many cases, almost no distinction been made between the song and the poem is an old one. The lyric poem, the poem played to the accompaniment of a lyre, or in the case of the Irish tradition, a harp, I suppose, is one that continued right up to the 20th century and, of course, nowhere more evident than in the work of W.B. Yeats. I was astonished recently as I took a swing through Yeats, another swing through Yeats, as one does, to be reminded of the extraordinary percentage of his poems that are songs. Indeed, the word song might be in the title. Many of them are ballads. Many of them rely very heavily on the refrain.
Well, true, Paul Muldoon, to your love of surprise and not having things simply as you might expect them to be, this is not the kind of setting of Yeats that you might hear down the pub. It's a serious contemporary piece of music.
That's right. Donoghue Dennehy is taking the Yeats poem and musicalising it.
These are the clouds about the fallen sun, the majesty that shuns his burning eye. The weak lay hand on what the strong has done, till that be tumbled that was lifted high. And discord follow upon unison, and all things at one common level lie. Thank you.
Setting of the poem by W.B. Yeats, These Are the Clouds, composed by Donica Denehy, performed by Dawn Upshaw, Alan Pearson, the Crash Ensemble, and Denehy himself. That was from the 2011 album, Gro Agus Bas. Tell me a little bit about Denehy, Paul Muldoon.
You know, Donica Denehy is one of the most interesting of the new Irish composers. As you say, this Gro Agus Bas, it's pronounced in slightly different ways, of course, depending on what part of Ireland.
That's a very nice way of excusing my bad pronunciation.
It's not actually. It's just the fact of the matter. People pronounce it in slightly different ways. He'd probably say Gro Agus Bas. Mm. I would say Gro Agus Bas, being from the northern part of the country and speaking, if I speak it at all, which is hardly ever, Donegal Irish. It means love and death. In a strange way, I think it's a reference to Yeats's comment once that the only two subjects that really should be exercising the mind of a thinking man or woman at all were sex and the dead, the only two things worth thinking about. Some of the ideas that I've been having recently have had to do with collaborations with Donica Denehy, for example, hoping to write something with him one of these days.
Are we right, do you think, to see lyrics and poetry as something slightly divided, or are you keen to see them as something that's brought together?
They are different things. They're different things, but they are akin, and they have slightly different modes. The waggish definition of the distinction has to do with the fact that the poem brings its own music. It brings its own tune, whereas the lyric needs something else. It's missing something to make it fully what it may become.
Bearing in mind what we've just been saying, how do you feel that Kurt Weill, for example, and this next piece fit into that?
You know, one of the things about Weill, I think, is that he has a way of undercutting himself and undercutting the text from word to word and from line to line. And this particular song is the September Song. And this is a version sung by the main singer, I suppose, of the Velvet Underground, and a somewhat unlikely candidate, perhaps, certainly on paper, and that's Mr. Lou Reed.
When I was a young man courting the girls, I played me a waiting game. If a maid refused me with tossing curls, oh, I'd let that old earth take a couple of whirls while I plied her with tears in place of pearls. And as time came around, she came my way. As time came around, she came. And these few golden
I suppose that it's possible that some Radio 3 listeners will be wondering if they should be switching channels when they hear Lou Reed there singing a Kurt Weill September song from Lost in the Stars, the music of Kurt Weill. And I suppose one of the things I'm interested in is the extent to which, particularly in the last 50 years, the notion of high and low and their irreconcilable natures, I think, has been pretty much dismantled. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm really not interested in what genre music might fall into. I'm really interested in whether or not it grabs me emotionally, if it gets to my core, or indeed intellectually. And
I love the fat bass in that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And, you know, bass is a wonderful instrument in any genre of music. But in terms of Lou Reed, you know, he's a rather wonderful writer himself. He studied, as you probably know, with Delmore Schwartz. He started out life as a poet. And again, I think these distinctions are really irrelevant at the end of the day, just as the question of whether or not Weill is working in the genre of the musical or the opera or music theatre or whatever term one, you know, might feel obliged to use of it. At the end of the day, it's irrelevant. It is what it is. It either works or it doesn't.
The same can be said of Cole Porter.
You know, I love Cole Porter. I would give anything, really, to be able to write as well as Cole Porter. You know, he is as agile and as intellectually nimble and as emotionally nimble as any poet, I think. And I suppose, in some sense, to borrow the title of one of his own songs, he's the top.
At words poetic, I'm so pathetic that I always have found it best, instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading, as I'll probably miss a bar. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're the melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're a Mickey Mouse. You're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa. You're the smile of the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flop. But if, baby, I'm the bottom, you're the top. You're the top. You're Mahatma Gandhi. You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy. You're the purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery. You're Garfo's salary. You're a cellophane. You're sublime. You're a turkey dinner. You're the time of the Derby winner. I'm a toy balloon that's fated soon to pop. But if, baby, I'm the bottom, you're the top. You're the top. You're a Waldorf salad. You're the top. You're a Berlin ballad. You're the nimble tread of the feet of Fred Astaire. You're an O'Neill drama.
you're the nose on the great Durante. I'm a lazy lout who is just about to stop, but if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top.
Wonderful combination of Cole Porter and Ella Fitzgerald there. You're the top from the musical Anything Goes. When you listen to those words, what do you pick out in particular? Is it just the wit or the combination of wit and intellect?
Well, I think it's both. And actually the warmth that comes through too. And the litany, of course, the impulse to make a list is one of the most basic urges in any kind of art making, and certainly in the business of poetry. The list is central, really, to how we live our lives. We make lists all the time. What are we going to do today?
Auden does it, doesn't he? And that wonderful Tell Me the Truth About Love.
Absolutely. It's a very, very basic impulse in us. And not only as poets, but as produce shoppers. We go out to the supermarket. And
inspired by Cole Porter, you've done it.
You know, I, in a very modest way, have attempted what might be, as I say, a very poor relation to a Cole Porter song. And one of the things I myself am interested in is bringing something of that, I suppose, for want of a better word, that kind of wit. I would like to see more of that in popular music. So this is a poem that's written, I suppose, to use a fancy term, in homage to Cole Porter. It's a song lyric that's one great list. It's called Dream Team. We used to be partners along the winding road, Lennon and McCartney, Ratty and Mr. Toad, Wyatt Earp and Dodge, the girl who's kind of miffed at the hodgepodge the three kings brought as gifts, a dog and its manger, strawberries and cream, Tonto and the Lone Ranger. We were a dream team. We used to be buddies in our college days, the spine and the shudder, the Mets and Willie Mays, the petard on which were hoist, Otis and the lift, the girder and the joist, working the graveyard shift. History and Hegel, the moat and the beam, locks and a bagel, we were a dream team. And then, of course, at that point, things are getting a little tedious in most songs after two verses and two choruses. It's time for the middle eight, time for the bridge, which has to do something else, and this is it. Until our efforts to tough it out of the rough became the stuff of nightmare. Until we came to believe with Mae West, saving love yields no interest when you're such a messed up pair. And then it goes back into the structure it established earlier on. Such a messed up pair as used to be partners in another life. Lennon and McCartney, Lott and his wife, the unconscious and Freud, Stella and Dean Swift, staring into the void before they're set adrift. Freuda and Shadden, Munch and the Scream, the Genie and Aladdin. We were a dream team.
Very good. Thank you, Paul Muldoon. Actually, I love the reference to Miss Otis. You know, the BBC is round the corner from here, and the lifts are Otis lifts, and they were never working when I used to work there as an announcer. And finally, some wag put a note up saying, Miss Otis regrets.
That's funny. Well, of course, upward mobility was never a feature of the BBC, was it?
Apart from these wonderful songwriters like Cole Porter, I wonder what else America has brought to your poetry.
You know, I've lived there for about 25 years. I'm married to an American. I have two, I suppose, American children. It happens to be where I live. It happens to be the place, because of that, that I most immediately try to understand. You know, I do very much love American English. I just, there's such a vitality, a vibrancy about American English that I just feel very connected to. Now, this is not to say, of course, that it's any more vibrant than Hiberno English or indeed, heaven help us, English, or UK, whatever we call it nowadays, UK or British English. It's such a fabulous language in which to try to write. You know, I suppose that there's a sense in America that things are still very much up for grabs. There's a sense of possibility, I think, in the US, which I find very exciting, and a sense that mostly there is an attempt to run a society that is fair.
This next piece you've chosen lives up to the pattern you have built of lots of things coming together. We've got the composer Stravinsky, we've got Auden and Chester Kallman's words, and so it really is a kind of cosmopolitan piece. How did you come to choose it?
Well, part of it has to do actually with the connection between Stravinsky and Warren Zevon. Warren Zevon, who met Stravinsky in California, Stravinsky coming towards the end of his career, of course, and Warren Zevon starting out on his. And they had some bond. And I think Stravinsky encouraged Warren Zevon to continue in his musical ambitions. And though, of course, he went a slightly different way. But who knows? I mean, had Stravinsky lived another 30 years, had he been 30 years younger, he might have gone into the old rock and roll himself. And Warren Zevon has, of course, a very particular poignancy for me, poignant in the sense that he died much too young, but also he was the person who, I suppose, got me interested in trying to write songs. He asked me if I would try to write a song with him, and, of course, I was thrilled at that prospect because I think he was one of the great songwriters of the era. So that's part of the connection also. He was very influenced by Stravinsky. This piece we're going to hear now is Anna Truelove's aria from The Rake's Progress. And The Rake's Progress had a libretto by W.H. Auden and Chester Kallman. Auden, indeed, another of my heroes, and one who gives me hope that it's not entirely crazy to try to write the odd song.
God,
In a strange way, I thought, Paul Muldoon, that the accompaniment, which is a very idiosyncratic, slightly dry sound, reminded me of the individuality of the accompaniment in the Denehy, These Are the Clouds.
You know, one of the things I would suggest perhaps that's happening in both cases there with Deborah York singing the part of Anne Truelove, and then in the other piece, Dawn Upshaw, is that there's a tension between the melody that's riding the wave, as it were.
And that's right. It's not just a soft cushion, is it?
It's not, because one's also conscious of the, as it were, the stones grinding away there on the ocean floor. The two things are happening at the same time. And, I mean, I think it's out of that tension, or some similar tension, that quite interesting art is made. And while I really am not an expert in music, far from it, I have a sense that that's one of the most effective things that composers, from what they tell me, are trying to do. You'll know more about this than I do, clearly.
Yes, it's rather like the way in which you make fire, isn't it? You rub two surfaces together that, in a sense, are alien. And sometimes in music, I think if you put a voice over something that's working against it as opposed to with it, you get an even more powerful effect.
And out of that quarrel, something interesting is happening.
We heard Anne Truelove's aria from Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress, which has a libretto by Auden and Kalman. Deborah York was singing the part of Anne, the rake's spurned but loyal lover, and the London Symphony Orchestra was conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Do you think that in just the same way that Bach has an influence on jazz, that Stravinsky has a kind of influence on rock music?
Well, I'm sure he does. And, you know, it's hard, again, to disentangle these genres. I mean, I am pretty sure that contemporary music in the popular mode, when you think of a band like Nine Inch Nails or so many others, they simply wouldn't exist without a composer like Stockhausen, for example. And I go to a huge number of rock concerts, much to the chagrin of my wife and family, I think, because I need to work two or three jobs to pay for the tickets. But I went to see a few years ago a band called Metallica. And Metallica is a band that is in some sense thought to be very, very basic. But actually, when you get right down to it, they're quite interested in varying time signatures. They're actually quite sophisticated in their way. And the crowd that goes to a Metallica concert, though, is generally quite monochrome. A sea of black leather there in the audience. And I happened to go straight from teaching a class at Princeton with another Princeton professor, a friend of mine, Nigel Smith, great scholar of, among others, Milton and Marvel. And he and I were sitting there in this amphitheater in our tweeds, our professorial tweeds, in this sea of black, and two women sitting right in front of us. And one, I could see one of them looking round every so often, and eventually she turned around to me. She says, "What are you boys doing here? What are you doing here? You look like a couple of college professors." So anyway, what were we doing there? We were there, I suppose, because of the allure of rock and roll, of the, as with so many forms of music, the trance-like condition into which it brings us. And one of my favourite versions, I think perhaps my favourite version of Metallica, is actually not played by Metallica itself, perversely, but by a Finnish band called Apocalyptica. And here they are playing Enter Sandman. We'll be right back.
Enter Sandman from the debut album of the Finnish metal band Apocalyptica, which was released in 1996. I realise some of the music on this programme will be new, as you already said to our Radio 3 audience, so worth mentioning perhaps that you can find all the details on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You are writing with a composer at the moment, I think, Paul Muldoon, writing libretti.
You know, I've had the pleasure of working with several composers. Just at the moment, I have been working with Mark Anthony Turnage, a piece called At Sixes and Sevens, commissioned by the City of London, tied into the 2013 City of Culture celebrations in Londonderry, or Derry, in Northern Ireland, and a piece having to do with the condition of Walldom, of the walls of Derry in particular. We had a reference to the wall, of course, in Mrs. Alexander's hymn. And At Sixes and Sevens is a musing upon the walls that shut us in and shut us out. And looking forward to hearing a recording of that one of these days. In the meantime, a recording of a piece called Fractured Lines.
And this was very much a sort of concerto, I think, for Evelyn Glennie and Pete Erskine. So you'll hear some quite delightfully kind of quixotic sounds here for percussion as they throw ideas around. Thank you.
that says it all. The 20th century, the 21st century, both centuries having to do with fracture. Fracture at the heart of all modernist art. The heap of broken images that Eliot describes. The paintings that represent the images that are falling apart.
Part of Mark Antony Turnage's Fractured Lines, and we heard the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Leonard Slatkin with Evelyn Glennie and Peter Erskine playing the solo parts. Well, you were talking about stirring things up a bit, and your choice of music, Paul Muldoon, probably has stirred up our audience a bit because it's very eclectic and challenging in places.
Well, it certainly stirs me up a bit, and I suppose that by extension, you know, one would hope that others might be stirred up a bit too. You know, what's the point otherwise? What's the point? We could all be doing something else. It's important to constantly put oneself in a position where one is forced to examine some of the thoughts that one has taken as been heaven sent throughout one's life. I think we all, I certainly do, find myself relaxing into ways of thinking, indeed having ideas for years that turn out to be completely wrong-headed upon reflection. And I think we have to be open to the possibility that what we've cherished along the way may actually be not completely unassailable. The great mentor for all of us, not only in Ireland, who are trying to write poems, is Yeats. And Yeats's mantra, myself I must remake. And I think it's a mark of any interesting artist, be it Stravinsky or Turnage, that they are constantly trying to reconfigure things, to challenge themselves, and thereby challenging the rest of us, you know? That's what being alive is about.
One of the composers from Ireland, who I think is actually somewhat neglected, given the quality of a lot of his music, is John Field.
John Field is a fabulous composer, best known, of course, for his nocturnes. But we're going to go out now with the polka from Hamilton Harty's John Field Suite, performed by the Ulster Orchestra when I lived in Belfast. I had the pleasure of hearing the Ulster Orchestra many times, and indeed they often combined with the BBC Orchestra, and indeed they were often led, as they are here, by Bryden Thompson. And there's a sense of coming round again here for me, which I find very beautiful.
Well, Paul Muldoon, many thanks.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The polka from Sir Hamilton Harty's John Field Suite, performed by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted there by Bryden Thompson. You may like to know that there's now a weekly download of Private Passions. You can go to the Radio 3 homepage and follow the link from there. Meanwhile, next Sunday at the same time, Michael Barclay's guest will be Rufus Wainwright. Private Passions was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
Beethoven's Choral Symphony in Radio 3 live in concert. The City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra's Beethoven cycle reaches its climax on BBC Radio 3, live from Symphony Hall. Thursday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to today. A very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to Radio 3 if you've recently tuned this way. I'm Ian Skelly, here to guide you through our programmes this afternoon. In just a couple of minutes, we're off to Bath to this year's festival and a concert given by Florilegium. And then at 2 to another festival, ongoing at the moment, the Aldborough Festival. A concert given last night, in fact, by the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, who performed with this year's artistic director, the pianist Pierre-Laurent Aymar. The conductor of the concert's also no stranger to the Aldborough Festival, Oliver Nusson. That's all at 2 o'clock this afternoon here on Radio 3. But before all that, let's catch up on the BBC News this lunchtime. It's read by David Cornett.
The US whistleblower Edward Snowden, who revealed details of secret American and British surveillance programmes, has fled Hong Kong. The American authorities have charged him with espionage, but Hong Kong said the US extradition request did not comply fully with the law. Mr. Snowden is on a flight bound for Moscow, from where it's thought he might fly to another country, such as Cuba or Venezuela. The organisation WikiLeaks says it's helping him to gain political asylum in a democratic country. The Chancellor, George Osborne, has said he believes the British economy is now out of intensive care. Speaking ahead of his spending review this week, he also said civilian jobs would go at the Ministry of Defence, but there would be no further reduction in the number of service personnel. The Pakistani Taliban has claimed that it killed 9 foreigners in retaliation for the death of one of its senior commanders in a drone attack. The tourists were killed by gunmen at a base camp at one of the world's highest mountains, Nanga Parbat, in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Rescue efforts in northern India, where thousands of people have been stranded by flooding, are being hampered by bad weather. It's feared that up to 1,000 people have died after roads, bridges and entire villages were washed away in floods caused by early monsoon rains. Labour's former Health Secretary Andy Burnham has rejected suggestions by a Conservative MP that he asked England's health regulator to tone down its criticism of hospitals in early 2010. Last week, a damning report accused the Care Quality Commission of covering up its failure to investigate properly the deaths of several babies at Furness General Hospital. Bomb disposal experts have been examining a suspicious item which was found in the grounds of a mosque in the West Midlands. 40 homes around the building in Walsall were evacuated. And the weather, it'll be a generally rather cloudy, cool and breezy day with blustery showers. These showers will be locally thundery in northeast Britain, while longer periods of rain are likely over northern Scotland. BBC News and Weather at 1:04.
David, thank you very much. We continue our series of programmes this afternoon that come under the banner of Britain 100. Paul Spicer will be here to introduce a personal journey through Benjamin Britten's choral music in this week's edition of The Choir. And you can hear a complete performance in that programme of an early piece by Britten for children's voices and piano, Friday afternoons. That's this afternoon at 5. And there's more choral music, by the way, at 4 this afternoon. A chance to hear the choral evensong service we broadcast live on Radio 3 earlier in the week, which came from St Paul's Cathedral in London. But now it's time for the early music show. And today, Lucy Skeeping is in the Church of St Mary's, Bathwick.
Today's programme comes from the 2013 Bath Festival, and I'm here with one of the featured artists at this year's festival, the Baroque Ensemble Florilegium. Not only have they been giving a series of concerts and workshops here, but they've also just given the first official performances of the two winning entries of the 2013 National Centre for Early Music Composers Award, a competition given in partnership with BBC Radio 3 and designed to encourage young composers to write new works for period instruments. and you'll be able to hear those winning entries alongside the other items in Florilegium's Concert from Bath in this programme. We start with some pieces by Jean-Marie Leclerc. He produced several books of chamber music, including his two Recreations, which contained easy-to-play pieces that sort of blended the lyrical Italian style with the French appetite for short dance movements. So here's the Overture and the Forlan from the second book.